America? It's a carve of a continent, a land so vast between the surge eternal and the surge eternal the clocks cannot agree, where gathers of basalt the size of mountain chains and plains the size of Sirius seas, whole flats of a map, cause us to say, here was a gravity estoppel. America, a country bathed in the trade winds of humanity at its most, huge in the feeding, in the grip of its sensation, hugely impatient, on to the next whop thing in a was of doing, a country of whoops and wait a minute, where no one takes time to find good footing, and the ambulances all spell backwards. A country of impacted traffic where toll collectors, before they take their station, take a leak. Cars emerge from oily berms, forge forward in the holy hope that green will find its light. Patrol cars pursue them with a glitter haste. Troopers standing in the rain write tickets out of certain deeply held beliefs. They are trained in the arts of violent response. A motorcycle triad idles by, potato, 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 on a mix of leaned gas, missed opportunities. Angels from hell, they are looking for the dark, crumbling overhangs of the Palisades where they will splash messages of love, their particular hatreds, and the year.
The voice of John Barr, B-A-R-R, reading from the poems of John Barr, in this case reading from Grace, the first half, and we just had a taste of that half, of The Adventures of Ibn Opsit, I-B-N-O-P-C-I-T, published this year, the two volumes together, completing this long book-length poem by Red Hen Press of Pasadena, California. Now, you may be saying to yourself, in addition to, wow, that's a really interesting-sounding poem, John Barr, I know that name. Isn't he the head of the Poetry Foundation? Well, John Barr is and will remain for 20 days or so the first president of the Poetry Foundation. We spoke with John and had a get acquainted session with him on this program 10 years ago, and now we're having a kind of exit interview with him as he prepares to retire from this position. The main thing, though, I want to say in introduction, aside from welcoming John back to WFMT and critical thinking, is the way that in one very interesting life, John Barr has combined being a poet with being a businessman, with being a successful businessman, with being a leader of organizations, with helping to create the Poetry Foundation out of the legacy of Poetry Magazine and its history and the remarkable largesse of a remarkable woman, Ruth Lilly, whose gift to poetry launched the set of, well, piece of history that we're about to discuss. So it's a chance for us to talk about being a poet and working with poets and the work that he's done with Poetry Magazine and the Poetry Foundation. John, welcome.
Thank you. And I have to say to you, Andrew, that if this is my exit interview, I can't think of a better place I'd like to have it. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Let's talk about John Barr, the poet, and we'll do it a little bit backwards because first I'm going to ask you to tell me something about what you just read and the concept of the whole project.
I'd love to. This book was 25 years in the writing, and it turned out that it's a two-volume mock epic. I draw a big distinction between a serious epic and a mock epic. One of the differences is that it's meant to be funny, and so I've tried to do that, gathering inspiration from everyone from Rabelais to Jonathan Swift to Dante. In fact, I've described the book as the three of them talking into a microphone at the same time.
In Caribbean English.
It's in a Caribbean English dialect, which to me became a very useful dialect. Dialects have an energy and economy that is all their own. And it basically, any dialect deals in the roots of words. It's emotional and efficient. Mm-hmm. I think Swahili is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, the two books together describe the arc of the life of a man who is forced by circumstances to come out of himself, his own private life as a poet, and come into the world. And through a series of adventures, we explore the individual, in this case a poet, with governments ranging from a corrupt Caribbean dictatorship to the last days of the Soviet Union on through America, and indeed even one of Africa's newest republics. And the theme of the book would be the individual versus the state. And as you can tell from my description, I'm rooting for the individual.
I think was it Yeats who said the poets were the legislators of the soul? Or I'm probably totally mangling that.
No, that's a good start. I think it was Shelley who called poets the unacknowledged legislators of the world.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good phrase.
On the one hand, you're the legislators, and on the other hand, none of you probably have seen many governments that you like, at least not the truly sincere poets.
Well said.
Tell us about your background, because it's an interesting one in and of itself, and it's also one where one might not predict either branch of your life's work.
Oh, thank you. Well, actually, I grew up in Lyle, Illinois, so I'm very much a product of the Midwest, and I love this region of the country. It's where I was formed as a person. After high school, Lyle Community High School, I went east for college as a scholarship kid for the Navy. This was in the 1960s.
But let's go back to Lyle. How did your family wind up there? I think your father was a railroad man?
He was indeed. My father was a career – he worked for the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy, which then became the CBNQ, and then it became the Burlington, and then the Burlington Northern. So he was – and my grandfather was actually a brakeman on those trains. So we moved around a lot. I was born in Omaha, but we, being a railroad family, lived in a lot of different towns.
Right.
And we finally settled in Lyle from first grade up through high school.
And what was your life like there?
It was wonderfully intense and also fairly alone, not lonely. I'll stick in a personal opinion here. I think there's a correlation between poets or people who become poets and spending a lot of time alone when they're young.
Mm-hmm.
I occasionally ask myself, can I think of any poets that come from big families where the noise factor, the decibel level, sort of is an enemy of a quiet moment? But I sort of grew up in the country, semi-rural, and spent a lot of time alone. And I think—
And you were an only child?
Or I had an older brother.
Oh, older brother.
But,
okay.
You know, it was not a big family.
Right.
And I think poets grow comfortable with solitude, and then they grow to like it.
Right.
And so I love my time. I've been married for 45 years, actually, to a classmate from Lyle High School. I'm certainly a family man in that respect.
Right. And what was your exposure to words, whether written or spoken?
I think I first became alert or aware of the power of language with a high school teacher who taught English. And I know from my work at the Poetry Foundation that quite often people awaken to poetry around the family dinner table or with a gifted teacher in school.
Right. And yours was a teacher?
Mine was a teacher.
And do you remember some of the things that you were introduced to then? Or?
Well, I remember writing poetry that was terrible.
There's a reason that even if you're a major poet, that volume in your life work is called Juvenalia. Right?
That's exactly right. Someone once asked the major American poet Wallace Stevens how he felt about that high school stuff, and he said, "It gives me the willies."
Yeah.
So I would be in that category.
Yeah.
I think the less remembered of that, the better. But
okay.
I was exposed to the anthology kinds of poetry, and then as I got into college, it became very important to me and has remained so.
So you're born in 1943.
Yes.
So when you're graduating from high school, things are heating up in Southeast Asia.
Yes.
And you took a path that was somewhat different from what we associate with a lot of people when we say the 60s.
Tell us
a bit about that.
I'd be happy to. My family, my parents didn't go to college. My brother and I were the first in our family to go to school. And we were a comfortable family, but we were not flush in terms of funds. So I needed to find a scholarship, and the U.S. Navy was creating scholarships where they paid for college or most of it. In return, you gave them duty to go to sea. I do remember a moment when I marched into the family living room and announced to my parents I was going to be a poet. And there was a pause. And my father, who was nothing if not practical, said, well, at least go to college. Then if you're a poet, people will say you're an eccentric and not just a beach bum. So that was good advice from the rest of my life. But I did ask him what I thought I should do about this Navy scholarship possibility.
Right.
And we went. This is an answer to your question, Andrew,
sure.
About Vietnam heating up. We went to the family library, and we had an old atlas from the 19th century sitting there. It wasn't a prize book. We opened to that part of the world, Vietnam, right. And it said Kingdom of Siam.
Yeah.
So
right. That
dates it all.
It really was a foreign place for you.
Exactly.
Right.
And my dad said, I think that's a good plan. I think you ought to go do that.
Yeah.
So I did do that, and I went through 4 years of college and then went on from there.
When you were in college in the first round of things, were you already working on English, or were you doing the range of liberal arts, or had the business spark hit you yet?
The business spark had hit me, but sort of in the wrong place.
Okay.
I didn't understand colleges very much, and I met with my freshman advisor, and I said, I want to be a business major. And there was another pause. And he said, we don't have a business major here at Harvard,
right.
So why don't you do something you like?
Oh,
and I said, well, I like poetry. So I became...
Well, that was good.
Yeah, so that became the course of my studies, and
right.
I took every poetry course I could find at college.
Were there particular teachers or visiting poets who had a special influence on you?
Yes, actually, there were many. And I fell in love with the work of William Butler Yeats at about age 19. I still have that book. The covers are falling off.
Right.
And he, for me, has met the test of a great poet in that his work has something to say to us at every stage of our life. So as we grow from adolescence, that early romantic stuff that he wrote, into the poetry of adulthood, maturity, and then into his life in the politics of Ireland. So
right.
His great work.
That is certainly true when you think through some people. And, of course, the greatest poets are comprehensive, however long or short their lives are. But there are many who write very fine poems about or filled with youth.
Yes.
Or old age, or reflection, or anger. But to have all of that, as Yeats does give us, is really quite something.
And he really lived the arc you just described, because he personally grew out of the Irish fairy mythologies. And he wrote a famous poem that said, I shall go naked in the world.
Right.
And I think Yeats gave English language poetry its first great dose of realism.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything followed from that.
And that both of those things come. You read those early poems, which are often rewritings of tales or whatever, and then you read poems that are
exactly
bam, bam, bam.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he was quite a figure. And so he was a big influence on me and continues to be today. And then I just started to float through the poets of the 60s, the people were then writing. Seamus Heaney was becoming known.
Yeah.
Frost was at the height of his powers.
Sure.
I took some courses that studied those poets, Wallace Stevens, others like that, and it was really an immersion experience for the next 3 or 4 years.
And then off you went to the Gulf of Tonkin or
the Kingdom of Siam.
The Kingdom of Siam, yeah.
What happened was I graduated and had my mortarboard on, and 1 hour later I had a uniform on and was headed for my first ship, which was happened to be undergoing repairs in the Boston shipyard. And then off we went the following year to the first cruise to Vietnam.
Your assignment was, at least to those of us who are not in the Navy, an unusual one. I mean, maybe you can talk a bit about what it was. You were not in combat, as it turned out. That's just chance, I guess. But you were definitely seeing the results of combat. Right?
That's a good way to put it. We actually were engaged in the war zone. The
right.
war zone is defined as the area where things are happening. And we were in that throughout. So I actually went three times. My ships went three times to Vietnam in the next 5 years. So in 1966, 68, and 70, we happened to be there for the Tet Offensive, which was January 1968. What our ship did was to follow the aircraft carriers around Tonkin Gulf and then safeguard the pilots. So if a pilot taking off crashed his plane but survived, we'd go up and pull him out. If, in fact, he was flying over North Vietnam at the time and his aircraft was hit by ground fire or missiles, he would always try to get back over the water, which for a Navy pilot is the safe place to be. Mm-hmm. And then we would have a helo that we would launch. And we rescued eight pilots in that 1968 mission who were shot down either over land or over water. And then we rescued four pilots in the final cruise, 1970.
Did you write about that? And if so, at the time? I know you did later, at least, or at least you wrote things that I saw later.
Yeah, yeah. I did indeed. And in fact, when I was full of poetry and ambitions to write when I went to the ships. So I had a copy of Patterson, the book by William Carlos Williams. And the wonderful thing about that book is he threw everything, including the kitchen sink, into it.
So ostensibly Patterson, New Jersey, but it's the whole world, right?
Patterson, New Jersey. And so one page has all the drilling records. It's just a listing mm-hmm. of people drilling for water mm-hmm. to supply the city. And I thought I would like to write a poem or a body of poem that would capture the modern warship experience, because all the poetry I knew of was about sailing ships and Bluebeard the pirate. And there's a gritty gray yes. steel reality to serving on a modern warship that really hadn't been captured. And so my ambition was to use those years to come up with a book, and that became my first book, which is called The War Zone.
At 10 a.m., the young housewife moves about in negligee behind the wooden walls of her husband's house. I pass solitary in my car. Then again she comes to the curb to call the iceman, fishman, and stands shy, uncorseted, tucking in stray ends of hair, and I compare her to a fallen leaf. The noiseless wheels of my car rush with a crackling sound over dry leaves as I bow and pass smiling.
Now that your big eyes are finally opened, now that you're wondering how must they feel, meaning them that you've chased across America's movie screens, now that you're wondering how can it be real that the ones you've called colorful, noble, and proud in your school propaganda, they starve in their splendor? You've asked for my comment, I simply will render. My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying. Superstition, you force us to send our toddlers away to your schools where they're taught to despise their traditions, forbid them their languages, then further say that American history really began when Columbus set sail out of Europe, and stress that the nation of leeches that's conquered this land are the biggest and bravest and boldest and best. And yet where in your history books is the tale of the genocide basic to this country's birth, of the preachers who lied, how the Bill of Rights failed, how a nation of patriots return to their earth? And where will it tell of the Liberty Bell as it rang with a thud over Kinzoa mud, and of brave Uncle Sam in Alaska this year? My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying. Hear how the bargain was made with her shivering children in 0 degrees. Blankets for your land, so the treaties attest. Oh, well, blankets for land is a bargain indeed. And the blankets were those Uncle Sam had collected from smallpox disease, dying soldiers that day. And the tribes were wiped out and the history books censored. 100 years of your statesmen have felt it's better this way. Yet a few of the conquered have somehow survived. Their blood runs the redder, though genes have been paled. From the Grand Canyon's caverns to Craven's sad hills, the wounded, the losers, the robbed sing their tale. From Los Angeles County to upstate New York, the white nation fattens while others grow lean. Oh, the tricked and evicted, they know what I mean. My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying. The past, it just crumbled. The future just threatens. Our lifeblood shut up in your chemical tanks. And now here you come, bill of sale in your hand, and surprise in your eyes that we're lacking in thanks for the blessings of civilization you've brought us, the lessons you've taught us, the ruin you've wrought us. Oh, see what our trust in America's bought us. My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying. Now that the pride of the sires receives charity, now that we're harmless and safe behind laws, now that my life's to be known as your heritage, now that even the graves have been robbed, now that our own chosen way is a novelty, hands on our hearts, we salute you, your victory. Choke on your blue, white, and scarlet hypocrisy, pitying the blindness that you've never seen, that the eagles of war whose wings lent you glory, they were never no more than carrion crows. Push the wrens from their nest, stole their eggs, changed their story. The mockingbird sings it, it's all that she knows. Ah, what can I do? Say a powerless few with a lump in your throat and a tear in your eye. Can't you see that their poverty's profiting you? My country, 'tis of thy people you're dying.
You come back from your time in the service, and you come back to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and it's a little bit different.
Yes, times have changed.
Yeah.
We're now not in the early 60s, but the late 60s after college and the 5 years at sea.
Did you feel alienated? Did you feel like you were on a different planet?
Well, certainly a lot had changed. We'd had the flags burned in Central Park, and we'd had I would say that the military veterans in those years were not universally embraced with a welcome home.
Right.
I didn't feel very much of that. I felt a little of it, to be honest, but I felt I immediately immersed myself in the daily life of business school. So I was there for an MBA. I was married to my wife, Penny. And we just took up the life of graduate students.
Right.
And so the campus at that point was really a separate thing from us.
Right.
We lived in a rental house. And,
right.
So that's how I went through business school.
And how was business school?
It was wonderful. Yep. That's when my dad's advice kicked in. So there was a particular reason that I was so motivated. I'd been basically on ice for 5 years.
Yeah.
Many of my classmates had figured out how to miss this thing called the Vietnam War.
Right.
And I was a matter of paying back a contract. So when I got there, they were all done with medical school, done with law school, and off on their careers. And here was I, still dripping wet with a sea bag in my hand. And so I put myself to work, and there was a benefit to that. I worked very hard, and so I did well academically. I was a so-called Baker Scholar,
right,
which was the top few percent of the class. And that got me the job on Wall Street and sort of set a career path for me.
We're speaking with John Barr, B-A-R-R, poet, former, for the most part, businessman. don't know what his future plans are, but we're going to find out. And for the last 10 years, the president of the Poetry Foundation here in Chicago. You're listening to Critical Thinking. I'm Andrew Patner, and this is 98.7 WFMT, and anywhere in the world, WFMT.com, the station being in Chicago, of course. Your first job on Wall Street, did you feel that you had to keep your poetry books in your back pocket?
I kept them locked in my desk.
Yeah.
Right? That's another way the world has changed. So I came into the workforce at the firm of Morgan Stanley in 1972 when I finished up business school. And I could just sense that when people were gathered around the water cooler talking about baseball games, it was not a good idea for me to talk about Yates.
So, hey, who's he play for? They sent him down.
That's exactly right. Maybe I could share with a quick story that talks about how that world worked. I was a junior associate. Everything I was exposed to was new to me, and I was learning a lot. One of the very senior partners took me along as the bag man, the associate, to a new business call at a Midwestern utility. We sat down in the man's office, and as a way to make conversation, the CEO of the company said, we have a crazy commissioner here, the people that set the rates in this state. And he said, just to show you how crazy he is, he comes to work in a jumpsuit. And he said, and do you know he writes poetry? There was another one of those pauses in my life.
I can't imagine.
I know. So my wonderful senior partner, he could have destroyed my career on the spot.
Right.
But he gave me a sidelong look, and then he let it pass.
But you never did wear a jumpsuit, at least in public.
Not to work, right. So that was the way the business world sat. Poets were sort of unusual and different, not part of that world. Over the next 30 years that I had on Wall Street, that changed. And so I was a lot less private about my writing life later, and especially after I made Partner, then I didn't have to worry so much about losing clients because it was too odd. And in fact, people were very friendly to it when they found out. And I think I've probably sold more books to business friends than I have elsewhere.
Sure, because you have that connection, and they haven't met another poet in many cases, right? Of course, you look now, and whether it works, who can say, but the curricula of business schools, they're telling people to be more well-rounded and to let the people in your interviews know about your interests and so on. So it has gone around.
It has. And in fact, part of the work of the Poetry Foundation is to make the business world more comfortable with the poetry world.
Right.
So our mission, which I'm sure we'll talk about here, is to get poetry back into the mainstream of American culture.
Right. And to make a bridge to that, let's just come to those last years in your business career and then what brought you back to the Chicago area and specifically back to Chicago. After Morgan Stanley, then, you actually did some projects of your own that were successful.
I did. I spent 18 years at Morgan Stanley. The last 10 of those years, I was the head of the public utility group, and I came to know very well the CEOs of a lot of gas and electric utilities all over the country. I retired from Morgan Stanley with two partners after 18 years, and we hung out our own little shingle. And we caught a wave we didn't even know was going to be a wave, which was the consolidation of the industry from 200 companies to about 100 companies. Yeah. And we were in the middle of that as advisors, and so we were blessed in that. And I also did another startup, one of the very first gas marketing companies, and it was an offshoot of my business with the utilities, serving the same industry but from a different angle.
It would have been easy, and there wouldn't have been necessarily anything wrong with it if you at that point had said, you know, Penny, we're going to go live in a houseboat now, or we're going to start raising cattle in Guernsey. But you were informed of, contacted by, a very unusual proposition came up, and one that almost seems that it would be written for you. And that is this little magazine, 90 years old then almost, but and historic, but with not a penny in its pocket, with no building, with no space of its own, with a very tiny staff, was given a gift that over time was shown to be in the $200 million range?
$200 million, right. Yes.
And there was a need for someone who understood poetry, understood how to put that money in a bank, and then understood what to do with all of that and how to somehow move between and among all of those worlds. How did you find out about this and what happened after that?
Wonderful question. First of all, the way you stated that was even better than the search committee put it.
Maybe I should switch careers.
I know, exactly. I had just finished up about 33 years on Wall Street and continued to have this active love for poetry. So I was teaching in the graduate writing program at Sarah Lawrence College outside of New York when the phone rang. And it was a search firm that said, your name has come to our attention, and we wonder if you'd have any interest in becoming the first president, the inaugural president of the Poetry Foundation. And they described what you just said in terms of the facts. I said, this is really intriguing, but of course, I've been out in New York for 30 years, so, you know, you can talk to me more, but I don't expect to be moving. And the more I learned, the more intrigued I became about this opportunity. The way I put this is the next time that a gift of that magnitude finds itself in the same room with a publication of the distinction of Poetry Magazine will be seldom, if ever, in my lifetime, right, and perhaps in the future of the art form. So it was a unique experiment to take money that had no restrictions. Ruth Lilly had no letter of wishes or conditions, and just the money parachuted into Chicago, and it was there for Poetry Magazine and the board that published the magazine to figure out how to put it to work for the benefit of all poetry.
Now, I'm not saying this as any kind of flatterer, and I am saying it, though, as someone who's watched the whole period of your time in Chicago, or your second round here in Chicago. And I have to say that, one, you set yourself some very serious goals when you came here, and you were pretty public about them. I mean, first, we'll come to that. You took time to talk with many, many people and to invite the public to share its ideas. But one of the things you started doing was you put out an annual report, a long letter, basically, about the way you saw the world and the way you saw things at poetry. And so you threw out a challenge to the public, really, and to your backers by saying, this is what I think. You couldn't do this, oh, no, I never said that, because you were saying it in – you're a poet. You were saying it in writing. And I have to say, from beefing up the magazine, continuing its excellent level of quality, building a building, which was a controversy – as an idea, it certainly has not been a controversy from the minute it opened. It has been hailed by everybody. To going into the digital age, which was growing up all around at the time, to getting back into schools, and there are several other areas. But each of these things that you said were going to be the mission, you did them. You had a very fine partner who had just been hired before you came, right? In Christian Wyman, Chris Wyman.
Absolutely.
His editorship is now matching almost exactly your time because he's going off to Yale, and his close associate, who you all hired, Don Scher, will be taking over as editor, and Robert Polito will be taking over as president. It's kind of magic.
It is magical, and it's remarkably coincidental. Chris Wyman got an offer, quote, he couldn't refuse. He was heavily recruited by Yale Divinity School to come and become a special person in their group with respect to poetry and what he will do there. And I think if I'd been him at his age, I would have done it too.
Right.
It just happened to be his 10 years at the magazine.
And 10 years is a good time, though, isn't
it?
Too many people stay too long or leave too early.
Yeah. Right? When I was offered the job for my job at the Poetry Foundation, I was asked by the board, how long do you want this job or will you commit? And I said, I'll commit to not less than 5 years or more than 10 years.
Yeah.
And then I explained why. I said, in my experience, because really the Poetry Foundation is my fourth startup.
Right.
I had three on Wall Street. And from a cold start, it takes 5 years to really create something. And this was a cold start. We had a big bank account, but nothing else except
right.
the magazine. And then if it's more than 10 years, it tends to become a personality cult built around the president. So it's not that now. And we've got wonderful successor in Robert Polito, and it'll go on with a terrific leadership.
You hear in that description the practicality and the reasonableness and also the foresightedness, I would say, of John Barr. And it's stuff that comes out of life experience and work experience, but also you obviously have an ability to step back from yourself and look at what you're doing and look at yourself. Is that a fair judgment
or
assessment?
Particularly the last part of that, look at yourself, that's what poetry does.
Yeah.
I think you have something that's out of joint inside of you, and the way it finds release is through or rectification is through expression in a poem. So, and I go back to my personal theory that poets are people who spend a lot of time alone when they're 16 years old and they get to like it. That's introspection.
Yeah.
So I think like all poets, I think about things.
We're going to come in the second part of the second hour of our conversation to these last 10 years and also your views about the future, both of the foundation and of poetry in general. But I want to carry on from what you just said back to how you write poetry, physically how you write poetry. Obviously, you had a long period where you had another job, and it wasn't only a 9-to-5 job when you have that kind of work. You're working and thinking about work a lot. And maybe you could describe for us what you do physically in order to create a work of poetry.
Sure. I can perhaps best answer that question, Andrew, with quoting a few lines from a poem that was published last year. It's called MSS, as in manuscripts. And I think it starts, since I start things on the margin, cocktail napkins, canceled checks, timetables trying to be reliable. And since I save it all, I know there are good words buried and lost in those fat accordion files.
Oh.
That's how I write.
I love it. I love it.
So I every poet develops a system that works for them. And in my case, it was to carry around with me 3x5 cards. And if I'm on an airplane or in the back of a taxi and a line comes, I don't ask questions. I just write it down.
You fold these cards.
I do. And they fit into my glass case and occasionally fall out.
So you fold them lengthwise.
I do.
And in a way, that kind of adds to the idea of accumulating fragments. Though,
oh, that's good.
Yeah.
And in fact, I got one in my wallet right now, which I'll read from. I wrote this on a walk. I was on our property a couple of weeks ago. So it was full spring and all the flowers are coming out. And I wrote, there's blue in the green of the lean athletic spears in the garden beds. Wordsworth doesn't own these daffodils, so I'll include them in this walk. You come too. And that may or may not be any good.
Right.
And it may or may not survive into a book, but it's the way I generate lines. I think I write lines and phrases as opposed to whole poems, and then I assemble poems out of that line stock. This would cause T.S. Eliot to roll over in his grave because he believed a poem had to have an organic nature that grew out of the first line. Frost might have said the same. So I'm probably in the business of aggravating great poets. But,
but the other thing that's so remarkable and would perhaps aggravate them more or might just stun them is that you're doing this while you're creating book-length poems, long poems with chapters. So it'd be one thing if you had three or four things and you put them together and changed the order. But somehow you're writing a novel in a way, yet you're not necessarily writing it in order.
Exactly. And in fact, I would compare this kind of composition I've just described to someone making a mosaic in a church, the first century church, where you have piles of colored stones and you create a picture, in this case a book, out of selected stones and in this case lines. So it's it works for me. I don't know of anybody else that composes that way, but it works for me.
I think we can think of a title, at least for an anthology, Selected Stones, I think would be a good one. What are you writing now? I mean, I know you wrote what you just read, but are you working on a project now, or are you?
I am, and this gets to my retirement, which I perhaps will talk about later, but I have a queue of projects that I can't wait to get going on. I've got an unfinished book-length poetry manuscript that is work in process, and it's in the persona of Aristotle in the last year of his life after his principal student, being Alexander the Great, has died in Asia on his conquest, and the people of Athens never liked him, and therefore they don't like Aristotle, and he's been exiled to his home island.
Wow.
And he's the notion of the book is as follows. Aristotle was the student of Plato, who was the ultimate man of contemplation, and he was the teacher of Alexander the Great, who was the ultimate man of action. So Aristotle, sitting there in the last year of his life, saying, "How did I get this wrong?"
I can't wait to see where that goes and to read that. I'm thinking of though it's a poetic in its style and has poetry in it. It is a work of novelistic fiction. But I'm thinking of Marguerite Yourcenar's Memoirs of Hadrian, where he's looking back at the end of his life and with a different kind of set of choices, but also very cultured conqueror and lover and so on. But I mean, it's the way I can't do this, but the way a poet or a fiction writer or a playwright can put him or herself into another persona and create, and that must must be like going on a ride in a way.
Well, it's someone once said that Nora Joyce, who is the wife of James Joyce, they occupied a very limited room. You know, he was always money challenged. And when he was in the middle of writing Ulysses, somebody said he might as well have been in Brazil, because he was mentally in another part of the world, a completely fictive realm of his own making.
Yeah.
I don't know how Nora felt about that. But
we should point out something else that's both just worth disclosing, but also I think gives you another sense of what kind of a man John Barr is. As the head of the Poetry Foundation, one might think, a listener who might be a bit skeptical or suspicious, thinking, well, of course his poems get published. He's the head of the Poetry Foundation. Who's going to say no? Well, you actually took yourself out of the business of promoting or even circulating your own poetry for this period. Tell us about that.
You're nice to ask, and I did. I worried about that, the obvious potential conflict of interest. If I send poems to some publication who's hoping to get something out of the foundation, and I wanted to create a system that would allow an editor of my looking at my work to say, I would rather die than publish this, but I'd never know it, so there could be no possible connection. So what I did was put the work into a blind trust. I hired a capable young man to basically submit the stuff in my name with a cover letter explaining that he was submitting on behalf, but I had no knowledge who it was.
Right.
And he, in fact, found my current publisher through that system. So it was a blind trust approach.
I love this concept of a blind trust of poetry or blind trust of literature. It's the ultimate taste test, isn't it? So, no, but again, and I must say, the young man did very well, too, because it's such a handsome volume, there are two matching volumes, beautifully designed hardcover, and they're in a slipcase.
It's a box set, right.
Yeah. And among those who have praised the work here and elsewhere, Alistair Reed in The New Yorker, Tom Wolfe, the great Billy Collins, the novelist Rick Moody, and Library Journal, and they're here in Chicago, but they're also they can't be one upped. I mean, they don't care who you are; they're only going to tell those librarians should you get this book for your library. I think that along with book lists, they're very very actually maybe it's book lists that's in Chicago. But the point is, these are pretty objective non-promotional outfits,
and they were very generous in their reviews. So yeah. I'm thrilled, and it was sort of done the right way.
Well, my guess is they weren't generous, but that they were honest and that they responded. This is part one of our conversation with John Barr, poet and outgoing president of the Poetry Foundation based here in Chicago. And in our next part of the conversation, we're going to talk about what the Poetry Foundation is, what John has done with his colleagues and fellows since he arrived here, and also we'll get into a little bit, in addition to Aristotle, of what he's hoping to do and where he sees the poetry world today. John Barr, what a pleasure to talk with you and have this very non-exit-y sounding exit interview with you.
Thank you.
Strengthened to live, strengthened to die for medals and positioned victories, they are fighting the blind man who thinks he sees, who cannot see that the enslaver is enslaved, the hater harmed. O shining, O firm star, O tumultuous ocean, lashed till small things go as they will, the mountainous wave makes us who look no depth, lost at sea before they fought. O star of David, star of Bethlehem, O black imperial lion of the Lord, emblem of a risen world, be joined at last, be joined. There is hate's crown beneath which all is death. There's love's without which none is king. The blessed deeds bless the halo, as contagion of sickness makes sickness, contagion of trust can make trust. They're fighting in deserts and caves, one by one, in battalions and squadrons. They are fighting that I may yet recover from the disease myself. Some have it lightly, some will die. Man's wolf to man, and we devour ourselves. The enemy could not have made a greater breach in our defenses. One piloting a blind man can escape him. But Job, disheartened by false comfort, knew that nothing can be so defeating as a blind man who can see. O alive who are dead, who are proud not to see, O small dust of the earth that walks so arrogantly, trust begets power, and faith is an affectionate thing. We vow, we make this promise to the fighting, it's a promise. We'll never hate black, white, red, yellow, Jew, Gentile, untouchable. We are not competent to make our vows. With set jaw, they are fighting, fighting, fighting. Some we love whom we know, some we love but know not. That hearts may feel and not be numb. It cures me. Or am I what I can't believe in? Some in snow, some on crags, some in quicksand, little by little, much by much, they are fighting, 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 that where there was death, there may be life. When a man is prey to anger, he is moved by outside things. When he holds his ground in patience, 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 that is action or beauty, the soldier's hardest armor for the fight. The world's an orphan's home. Shall we never have peace without sorrow, without pleas of the dying for help that won't come? O quiet form upon the dust, I cannot look, and yet I must. If these great patient dyings
all these agonies and wound bearings and bloodshed can teach us how to live. These dyings were not wasted. Hate-hardened heart, oh, heart of iron, iron is iron till it is rust. There never was a war that was not inward. I must fight till I have conquered in myself. What causes war? But I would not believe it. I inwardly did nothing. Oh, Iscariot, like crime, beauty is everlasting, and dust is for a time.
The power.
make things all right.
Poems and music that we heard today, selected in part as counterpoise and in part as complement and complement to our conversation with John Barr, the 1916 William Carlos Williams, The Young Housewife, read by William Carlos Williams in the late 1940s on a remarkable Columbia LP, Pleasure Dome Audio. That sounds like a very contemporary name, doesn't it? An audible anthology of modern poetry read by its creators, available now in all manner of CD and digital form as well. And that led right into Buffy St. Marie's classic, My Country, 'Tis of Thy People, You're Dying, 1964 song by the then 23-year-old Buffy St. Marie from her 1966 album, Little Wheel, Spin and Spin. And then after our conversation, we heard also from Pleasure Dome, Marianne Moore's quite controversial 1944 war/anti-war poem, In Distrust of Merits, read also by its creator, in this case, Marianne Moore, from that 1949 Columbia Pleasure Dome LP. And then, corny as it might seem to have selected it, it fits, and it's a beautiful song still, Poetry Man, by another 24-year-old, Phoebe Snow, back in 1974 from her self-titled album, The Late Phoebe Snow. She died about 3 years ago, stroke at the age of 60. We'd like to thank, of course, John Barr and Kristen Gecken from the Poetry Foundation, especially because we had to recreate this interview, and we did it. We did it. Thank you, of course, to Matt DeStefano for creating and recreating and making the program sound great. To our funders, Alphawood Foundation, Dick and Susie Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line via chimein at WFMT.com, via Facebook at WFMT, via email, rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. You can hear this or any of our other programs at WFMT.com/Critical Thinking, home to the always free Critical Thinking podcast. And next week, we will talk again with John Barr, this time about the building up of, the work of, and the literal building of the Poetry Foundation. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.